Hello, this is Peter Hill Explains, where I've been conducting recent extended podcast tutorials on sections of the 2017 physics exam, basically to help people going through. And I've done the last one, medical physics and quantum quark. And what's happened is that I've been just testing myself in terms of being able to explain and do answers. There's actually nothing that I was expecting to really stuff up, sort of not be able to remember things. But then I would test myself against the answers and I'd discover some of the answers would be a bit wrong. So this is a bit different now. I've actually gone through and tested the answers at the back. And yes, for this section, it's all okay. So this is Peter Hill Explains, and the idea is this is to provide a general resource for people doing the HSC physics exam, but also for international people who are just interested to listen to, very rarely, I can't imagine it, but want to listen to what's a high school set of physics questions. And in this case, we have a option system where 25% or one out of the four terms is done on a specialised topic. It's sort of like the core topics, everyone in the state does the same thing, but it allows your school to specialise in an area which maps the interest of the teacher and also the general population. This is astrophysics, and again, there's typically five questions and three in the first pages of the book and the last two in the last pages of the book. I'm just going to go through and see if I can answer these questions. I do know I can, of course, because I've gone through it. And this is probably a bit easier to understand, so it's just the question and the answer going through. And the question A, part two, for 2 marks. Why do space-based telescopes provide more information than a similar-sized Earth-based optical telescope? Okay, so they're both optical telescopes. The two major reasons is that the space-based telescope, I can obviously think of three reasons. There's four reasons. Oh, there you go. So the reasons are, one, because they're orbiting, they have got more hours of observation. They've got essentially 24 hours worth of observation, given that they don't pass or don't necessarily pass through the Earth's shadow. Five's reasons, because they're in space, they can be shielded and go down to lower temperature. Because they're in space, they can be rapidly pointed without vibration or noises due to that, because they can use their space-based gyros to get places. Fourth reason, because they don't have the atmosphere in front of them. The atmosphere absorbs certain wavelengths of radiation, ultraviolet and infrared, so they can access greater spectral information. And finally, the fifth one is that the atmosphere has distortions in it, and they can accommodate and not be affected by the distortion as much. There's five reasons then. Okay, it's amazing that just doing that, I'd be able to pick up five reasons. Two stars, P and Q, have an apparent magnitude of 10.3 and 8.5. Use the brightness ratio to compare the two stars. So there's a formula provided, and the brightness ratio is a rather amazing thing. So the 10.3 star, which P is less bright, and the actual physical ratio of brightness or efficient watts giving into your telescope or your detector, calibrated detector, is 100 to the power of magnitude P minus magnitude magnitude Q on 5. It's just divided by 5. It's just convention that they do to get the magnitude scale, and the answer goes, I think around 5 times different for those two. It avoids natural logarithms, but the divided by 5 gets it fairly close to a natural logarithm, because that's 2 dB, which is about 5. It's the actual reason why the astronomical one is to do with logs of 10, but to actually avoid some of the issues there. Okay, and look, I'll just describe them. B, the diagram, part one, the diagram shows positions of X and Y in the HR diagram. So X is on the blue section of the HR diagram, the main sequence, and Y is on the Y section. They also show dotted there a horizontal branch from stars which have left the main sequence there. Oh yes, and they even show the light white dwarfs down there on the left hand side. They show the magnitude as they get brighter. It's a smaller number, the absolute magnitude, and the sun is an absolute magnitude of zero in this case, and this appears to be mislabeled here, unless I'm... Oh, it's the luminosity, correction. The luminosity is on the other side. How bright it... our sun has the luminosity of 1, and according to this, an absolute magnitude of 5, plus I've learned a new thing. And then on the bottom they have the spectral type, and we have a G-type star, and red ones are K and M, and blue giants, or blue, very blue stars, are O and B. So we're G, I think we're G subscript 2. And it says, outline the difference of spectra's X and Y. So this is something that you really generally need to study, a whole set of spectras. This is basically something you need to know. So the X spectra, which is B class, will have will be very hot. So there's two components, or three components for it, and that's the first component is the black body radiation. It will have a black body continuum focused in the blue, maximum in the blue, and tailing off to the left, the actual spectra. Then it'll have emission lines, depending on it, will have high emission lines, highly ionized emission lines, and I suppose a few absorption lines in it. The Y one will be have very little blue. It will have a black body peak at say 3,000 or less degrees from here in the red or infrared. And it will be much cooler, so there'll be molecular lines and gas absorption lines. So it'll be so cold that molecules will be able to form. Part two is describe the process which can be used to obtain a spectrum of an individual star. And this is one of the things I'm sparing you of reading it. One of the processes they say is that to provide a spectrum, you have to actually put it through some dispersive medium, or apply filters to it, a series of filters to it, but I think they wouldn't like that. The process is that they describe is that you can put a diffraction grating in front of a telescope and then absorb it, observe it. Now you can imagine that, I can't imagine a very large telescope having a very large diffraction grating which you can actually put on top and damage. In fact, I've never heard of a diffraction grating in front of a telescope. However, you can focus the image just before it's re-imaged onto its image plane. You can put it through a prism system creates a spectra at the point of each individual star, so the stars actually moved across, or you can actually have optical fibres. Is a fairly famous Australian echidna one, where they have optical fibres which are placed on the actual observation point of it. And again, the actual optical fibres can be a fibre array, or it can be actually individually spaced fibres, and that fibre array goes through some sort of diffraction grating. And so the important thing is to say for each individual star has been separated out to be diffracted or dispersed and that spectrum is spatially dispersed, so you have now for one star several detectors for each spectral point. C, a star has a negative colour index. Okay, so colour index is the B magnitude minus the V magnitude. Now, the, this is from really going back to actually before spectroscopy. Well, that's another way of finding spectrum, but what would happen is they'd get your star just before the plate. They'd put in a set filter. So you can buy these filters, and they're B filters and V filters. So V filters pretty much look much like the eye. You look through it, the eye is there. A blue filter lets the blue through but attenuates the red wavelengths. If something is has a greater light through the blue filter than the than the visible filter, that's it's a negative number to start off with. So a negative minus a smaller negative number, it's a net negative number. So I don't know if I've explained that so much. So if it's got a negative colour index, it's particularly blue, and again, you'll have to just rote learn this, that if it's got a negative colour index, it's off to the, what is it, it's above 10,000 degrees, it's above spectral class, I think it's class B. It won't be quite easy. Oh no, it could be, it can't be B, probably A or F if it's got a negative colour index. D, use a labelled HR diagram, which is rather easy because they've given you a HR diagram to show the area in which stars will be plotted for a typical open cluster and a typical globular cluster. Well, just really quickly, a globular cluster is formed by, it's a relatively young cluster, it's formed by shockwaves and collisions within the galactic plane. That's where you've got lots of gas and lots of shockwaves happening, blowing up their relatively young star production, but they're in the galactic plane, so there's a lot of things, tidal forces, things moving, happening in the galactic plane. So they don't last very long. They're necessarily relatively young stars. So there's because they're recently born, so they'll have the entire main sequences of the very first situation for an open cluster will be just the main sequence, where a globular cluster is formed outside the galaxies. They're actually mini galaxies, and they don't have a big central mass inside them, and so they're relatively the stars which are going to escape have escaped a long time ago, and so they've got ancient stars in them. They've all been born at the same time, and so the large stars which have shorter lifetimes have a turn off and leave the main sequence, go off to the red giant phase, and then towards the end of the red giant phase, when you actually get convection in the core, this is something that's actually doing my head in. Convection in the core goes back to the blue, so it you've got the HR diagram, which goes in the OCN, or in the nitrogen-oxygen carbon cycle. It has a kick up there, whereas the globular clusters are old, and it's a bit like a chicken bone. I imagine a chicken breast bone. It sort of it has a turnover up into the horizontal branch, and then from the horizontal branch, it's got it's got to tick over into the globular cluster, then it has a horizontal branch into the stars, which go back, they're going back to the main sequence, but they're, in fact, stars which are about to explode. Okay, Oh, well, there you go. Outline the differences between stars in open clusters and globular clusters. So stars in open clusters are necessarily younger stars, and they're on the main sequence stars. I've ex basically explained that. And open stars in globular clusters are ancient stars. Have a distribution of, they're all ancient stars, they're all old stars, so stars still in the main sequence have been there for a very, very long time. I hope I've explained that. I won't go into it anymore. Explain how gravitational forces affects the deaths for a range of solar masses. So you ha for this you have to remember the solar masses, and I think for me, I think the solar masses, I remembered, I just have to cheat here and actually go back to the numbers. I remember 1.4 and 4 solar masses as the critical times for it. So you have our stars at our place where they become where they die, become red giants. Nebula, supernova, explode. Or they explode, leaving behind a white dwarf, a neutron star, or a black hole. I'm just going to read the sample answer for you because that's probably going to be easier. Gravity causes stars having, oh, I was right, star mass less than 1.4 mass to collapse to form a white dwarf when nuclear fusion ceases. So a white dwarf is, there's no nuclear fusion inside it. Stars, 1.4 to 8 solar masses, I think, expels some of their mass to space. They're the planetary nebulas, or form a nebula. Stars between 1.4 and 3, I would have said 4 solar masses, I must be out of date. Once fusion ceases, stars cause the protons and electrons to form neutrons, and neutrons, or pulsars, stars form. Stars having oh yeah okay stars having final masses greater than 3 solar masses, gravitational forces are stronger and cause that to form a black hole. Of course, it's not necessarily the gravitational force. You have oh, this is not taught obviously. You have a pressure wave on the outside, and a pressure wave actually causes it to explode. The implosion is sufficiently strong, it's not necessarily gravitational force. It's actually compressed such the the gravitational force doesn't form the black hole. The implosion compresses the matter, and the matter gets compressed to such a density and such a mass that a black hole is formed. And what happens is you get a Newton's third law recoil as the surface evaporates. You've got to have the supernova, the expulsion of gas. And I'm surprised, why you'd have an 8 solar mass limit there, but the surface evaporates and pushes in the star such that it basically. So the pressure wave, so you've got pressure sensitive nuclear fusion. So the pressure wave begins to build, but when the pressure wave is such that it promotes nuclear fusion, you get a nuclear powered pressure wave going in, and that gets you the supernova. One of the things I've just learnt recently, that closes that particular one topic off. One of the things that I have learnt recently, which is very interesting, is that you have a range of core convection layer types. And yeah, look, it requires me to study even more. So in very small stars, you have a very large convection layer. And in fact, the core itself, the convection layer, goes all the way through, and there's actually very slow nuclear fusion happening in convection all the way through. So I think there's no solid core irradiative zone. There's no convection, so it's effectively a solid, or butter, so to speak. Like butter's not moving about the place; it's nice and soft. You can move through it. And if you place something in convection zone, it should well, it is by definition, will stay there. It won't, it will, I suppose, slowly diffuse, but there's no mass movement of a large section. If you put a take a differential segment of it, it will stay there forever. The mass will slowly go in, and atom by atom, things diffuse in and out of it, including heat will diffuse it. So our star, the inner two-thirds of our star, is the radiative zone, and it's radiative, but there's no convection, nothing moves. Then we get the convection layer. But in very large stars, that radiation zone gets even bigger and bigger until it's 99%. Yeah, very, very small percent of the convection layer on the top. There's a new regime, which I didn't know about, which is at super high pressure, convection takes up again, and your core has convection inside it. And so that's an interesting thing. And, of course, a heat transport is much better with convection, as you know, in terms of you can stand in front of a hot fire and you feel the heat through radiation, or I suppose radiation, space, free space radiation. But you can feel a burner blowing very hot, but it takes a long while for that same heat to travel down the leg of the heater, down through the concrete, and reach you that way. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Hill Explains. In the meantime, please keep on thinking, doing, and teaching science.